Hey Gary, why do some patriots think America is still a British colony?
I don't know how often I run into that, and I've done some research on it, but it's kind of a bogus argument, and I don't know why people want to say that even. We don't have a queen, we don't have a parliament, we don't have any, we don't use British money. I mean, Canada has the queen on the coins, Australia has the queen on the coins, and they're independent now, but they still got the queen on the coins. So we have dead presidents. We're one of perhaps the only country in the world that puts dead people, not live ones. There's an old saying, how does it go? To Rome, what belongs to the emperor, but the coins all had the emperor's picture on it, and so the coins all belong to the emperor. But we don't do that. We chose dead presidents and a few other characters, crazy ones. For our currency, because there is no obedience to a sovereign. The concept that the sovereignty resided with the people, and they relinquished some of that sovereignty when they created the state constitutions, they relinquished some of that sovereignty when they gave to the federal constitutions, is totally opposed to the concept of a monarchy.
Well, what about this claim I've heard over the years that British troops allegedly did not leave until 1796?
Well, there's some truth to that. Now, during the Revolutionary War, the forts that were in Detroit, Vincennes, and all these other places, Charleston, New York, the only two that were really retained by the British by the 1781, some of the small forts in the South were still retained, but they slowly got pushed back into Charleston. So by the time of the treaty, 1783, basically Charleston and New York were the only remaining Revolutionary War combat type forts of the British in the country, and they vacated both of those as soon as word of the treaty being signed was passed down. Now, the British, though, especially through Canada, had been doing fur trade forever, not quite, but for a very long time, and Canada primarily was commercial, was fish or furs. At the time, it wasn't being populated quite like the United States was. And so there was a lot in the Northwest Territories, there were a lot of fur trading posts, and they had military contingents to protect against the Indians and things like that. And the British didn't do anything about it. And in 1795, Jay's Treaty was executed, and it was to vacate the rest of the military posts in the Northwest Territory, among other things. And when that was executed and agreed to by the Crown, then they began moving out of the Northwest Territories. So yeah, they didn't really vacate, but they weren't fighting people. I mean, there might have been some sneaky stuff going on. They might have tried to discourage American settlers by sending Indians on them, but there was no war or combat going on at the time. It was just they were trying to retain their foothold, both to the Mississippi River area, or access to the Mississippi, and the fur trade that would go up to Canada and back to England. So it's true, but it had nothing to do with the United States doing much more than not dealing with it until 1795 with the Jay Treaty.
Okay, well, I mean, it's something that's just kind of bugged me because there are these claims that, well, I don't know. It's almost like people are confusing their mere whims and opinion as if they were facts, and then they use a bunch of sources and then claim, "Look, I made this claim," and then they give you a list of like five or six different sources. And so, unless you're going to look at each one and see whether it supports a claim or not, it's kind of gets a little tedious at times.
Well, that's true, but if you look at the wilderness areas then, the Northwest Territory, I mean, Daniel Boone and some of these people went over the mountains and started settling out there, but it was very slow. And even though a lot of land went out as rewards for military service, bounty lands, still it didn't reach way out in the Northwest colonies. It tended to grow outward. You know, Pittsburgh was, Vincennes were about the westernmost, well, down by St. Louis, along the river corridors, they were pretty much the extent of the settlement. People might have gone beyond there, but when you're talking about a family of three or four people, being all that there was within 20 or 30 miles of their cabin, there was no competition with the British. The British weren't affected by that. Nowadays, we'd look at British troops in American soil, unless they were here for training purposes or something like that, as offensive. But back then, there was a lot of land out there. And so it was really inconsequential. It was more a matter of principle. The British kept claiming that people that didn't have the proper papers were British citizens, and they'd take them off the ships and put them on the British ships, American ships, and put them on British ships. And they had these intrusions in the Northwest Territories. And so the Jay Treaty was to resolve that. Look, you signed a treaty. You can't claim somebody's a British citizen just because you want to. And so they tried to resolve these problems. Now, the one about taking sailors off of ships was one of the elements that led to the War of 1812, which we declared against England. But the forts were pretty much moved out after the Jay Treaty. And I think it was September of, I'm not sure, I think it was September or November of 1794. And you know, word traveled slowly. It could take up to 3 months to travel across the country, and then it had to go by way of Canada and down to the forts. So it might have been 96 when the last of the troops went out, probably early 96, because that would have allowed plenty of time. But so they were here, but it wasn't an offensive or an occupying or a right of conquest or anything like that. And it's absurd to try and make it more than it is when you just got these little areas where they're protecting the fur trade.
Well, I mean, one thing that kind of was just rather irritating to me about this claim about British troops not leaving until 1796 is that some of the sources for this that are cited seem to have come before that year. I mean, for instance, I know one source was, I believe it was called Res Publica versus Sweers, cited at 1 U.S. 41. And that case was decided in 1779. I'm not quite certain how a case, United States Supreme Court case, decided in 1779 proves that the British troops did not leave until 1796. Can you?
Well, there wasn't even a United States then, was there?
Hmm.
There were the lowercase United States, capital, but the proper noun, or the noun was quite frequently capitalized then. They were united under the Articles of Confederation, which wasn't really signed until 1781. It wasn't ratified by all the states until 1781 anyway. So this is in Philadelphia. What was Philadelphia? Well, it was the capital of the Continental Congress, but it was Pennsylvania. That's all it was. It had nothing to do with the rest of the colonies except the unity under the Articles of Confederation. But yeah, the case was held in 1778, and it was decided in 1779, and so I don't see how it plays in any part. You found a source where they're making these claims, and so they're claiming the future. They must have, you know, had a prophet or something that said the British troops won't leave. So, but it's not in the case. So
yeah, and I'm sorry, I misspoke. Right, because it wasn't until the 1780s when the Constitution was ratified, and there was a United States Supreme Court. So actually, at this time in 79, it would be probably the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, I think.
Right,
would probably be the case. Yeah. Okay.
Right. There was no Supreme Court of the United States until 1789, 10 years later.
Right.
It was submitted in 1787, ratified in 1789, and the first Congress really sat in 1790, and the president was elected, and so and then they established the system. Actually, it was 1790 would be when the United States Supreme Court really came into existence as a functioning body.
Well, there was also another source too, a couple of years before then. I believe it was called, it goes by different names. I think one name was called the Articles of Association or the Continental Association of 1774. Again, kind of the same problem. I don't see how an association or articles of anything in 1774 prove that British troops didn't leave until 1796.
That was the association that created the Continental Congress long before the Articles of Confederation. Not long before, but before the Articles of Confederation. That was the association, not a country by a long shot. It was in the common interest of the 13 colonies to band together to deal with the British problem. They're the ones that issued the, as that unified body, but not a country, issued the Olive Branch Petition and the Declaration of Independence, respectively, in 1775 and 1776. But no, it wasn't a country, and the Articles of Association were simply that. We're going to work together to deal with the problems we have with England, and this is 2 years before the war began. Or a
Yeah,
year,
or
I'm sorry, a year before the war began.
right. Yeah, Lexington and Concord, as it were, sure.
Yeah, or 6 months or so, but
Right, it was roughly around that time. Well, like another source too that supposedly backs up that was alleged to back up this claim about the British troops was oddly enough, to jump around in time a little bit, is IRS publication 6209. Again, I'm not quite sure what the IRS has to do with any of this, but it seems a little odd, to say the
well,
least.
let's go to that one. It's kind of interesting. The IRS publication 6209 is available online. There are a couple of places, and I'm not sure why it's a public document and they've got blackouts in it, but I think what these people are trying to create out of nothing is it does make reference, it makes no reference to Britain or England or Great Britain or the anything like that. It does mention the IMF. Oh boy, that must be bad. Wait a minute. The IRS has individual master files on every taxpayer and non-taxpayer in the country. They got
Okay,
one on me,
so
they got one on you. IMF. It's not International Monetary Fund, where they might be trying to use that to create some expansive bridge that makes it British.
okay.
Okay, but it's not the International Monetary Fund, it's the individual master file that they refer to over and over in there. And so I think that that is the broad leap, the conclusion jumped to by people that really don't understand what they're talking about.
I guess the only other thing I can think of as the as an alleged source for this claim about the British troops in 1796 is I think it was called the Treaty of Peace.
Ah, the Treaty of Peace, yeah, 1783. The Treaty of Paris is another reference to it. It's an interesting document, and people have used it to justify we still belong to England. And well, this might be a little boring, but I don't want to leave anything out so that but I will emphasize the pertinent parts. It having pleased the divine providence to dispose the hearts of the most serene and most potent Prince George the Third, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain, France, Ireland, Defender of the Faith, Duke of Brunswick and Lunenburg, Arch-Treasurer and Prince-Elector of the Holy Roman Empire, etc., and of the United States of America. Wow. He just said he's the king or prince or something of the United States of America. Well, let's see. That's what's been cited to me as the claim that the king still owns the United States of America. But wait a minute, the United States of America, that's a country. He's referring to it as a country, not as a colony, not as 13 colonies, but a country. But let's look at it a different way. I own my property here. And if I sell my property in that deed first, I have to show that I'm the owner. And then I convey that ownership to the buyer. So what he's saying is he was, and of the United States of America, is really not clear what he was, because this is after he elected to the Holy Roman Empire. But what he's doing is saying that he has authority to deal with the United of the land that is now the United States of America. So then further on he says, excuse me just a minute, I've got to find it. It's a long document, I should have highlighted this. I knew we were going to go here, but the Treaty of Peace proposed to be concluded between the Crown of Great Britain and the United States of America, and the United States, he doesn't say of America this time, and the United States. So what he's doing now is talking about an agreement between, that's kind between the two parties. Now, if he retained it, there would only be one party. And then he says, then he recognizes Franklin and John Jay and who else as plenipotentiaries. That means that they have the authority to of the United States of America, the authority to speak on behalf or to receive this treaty. And then he relinquishes further on. Let's see. Article 1, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges that the said United States, viz. New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantation, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, to be free, sovereign, and independent states, that he treats with them as such, so he's treating them as independent states, and for himself and his heirs and successors relinquishes all claim to the government, property, and territorial rights of the same in every part thereof. So Article 1 now sets the distinction. He releases them from himself, his heirs forever. I mean, would they ignore this when they read it?
Or yeah, that kind of... far? That kind of begs the question, right, about whoever made this claim about the British troops. It's almost as if that they claimed that the peace treaty proved it, except if they had just read Article 1, that would have debunked the claim right from the beginning.
It would, but they read the first paragraph and said, oh, wait, hey, he owns the United States of America. We'll stop there. There's nothing more to read.
Yeah, that's why if you're going to cite something and make a claim about it, that's why you should read the whole document or the whole source or whatever it is. Wow. Well, actually, I think this kind of nicely segues into something else I want to ask you, which also used this same treaty as a source, which is this claim that, you know, did King George III of England secretly finance the Founding Fathers?
I don't think so. I think France and Holland did most of the financing. But I think what leads to that conclusion is Article 4. It reads, it is agreed that creditors on either side shall meet with no lawful impediment to the recovery of the full value in sterling money of all bona fide debts heretofore contracted. That's the one that deals with finance. So if that's the case, is he talking about, is that implying that that we owe him money, or is this implying that if tobacco was shipped to England prior to the war and the English people owe on that tobacco, they have to pay that debt, and if money was owed to England by the people from the United States for goods that were sent over, like Jefferson buying all those books, that he had to pay that debt? And further, it implies that if I had land here and I was a Tory and I left, that I have a right to that property and can be have a right to be paid for it if I want to transfer ownership. See, I don't know anything else that would imply that the there was any lending by the King of England.
Yeah, it almost that one sentence in that makes up the entirety of Article 4 of the peace treaty almost sounds more like, you know, no one is allowed to welch on their debts, which sounds more of a, which sounds pretty equitable. But this, I don't see any how anyone could construe this to mean that the English monarch was somehow in cahoots with the founding fathers, like controlled opposition or something. I don't see any evidence of that here.
No, there's not. And let's look at the relationship between the two. When we were colonies, there was a lot of trade going on. In fact, they funneled the trade. We could not sell tobacco or cotton to anybody but England at one point. You know, it was is and then they got to make the profit and pay us little and charge more to sell to other countries. That cotton, the tobacco, a lot of the wood, they raped all the trees in England and most of Europe by that time. And so a lot of naval stores came out of the colonies. You know, they were cutting masts for ships. We had big tall trees. All the big tall trees went to masts a long time ago over in Europe, from Florida to the New England states. Naval stores were common. Trees, the slash pines in Florida, were used for. They draw the sap out and make what was a turpentine out of it. I mean, these things were there, and now British would lose. Britain. Now this is includes commerce in it, fisheries and everything else. But the thing is, they wanted it, and she said at the beginning, we want to continue the beneficial commerce or whatever his phrase was at the time. So they wanted to hold open the door that they could still buy these things from us. Of course, they didn't have the power to control the prices then, or to tax the hell out of it on our side. They could only tax it on their side, but they wanted to keep this trade going. So to do that, would you trade with somebody that still owed you money and you're going to ship him more stuff and hope he pays you? No, let's settle the debts. If we're going to have commerce, we've got to be above board on our financial individual financial obligations. So what he's trying to do, what they're doing, both sides agreed on it because we wanted somebody to buy all this stuff, the cotton, the tobacco, and the naval stores. And it wasn't just England, but to keep it with England, there had to be a resolution of recognition of debts. Now let's go back a little bit to the within the United States proper. We can go back to Worcester, Massachusetts in March of 1774 when they closed the courts. All through Western Massachusetts, they closed the courts. They would deal with criminal matters, but they would not deal with civil matters. So basically, any obligation for debt would not be heard by a court, so there could be no resolution unless somebody went up and shot somebody and stole his money. So we have a hold on debt as early as March of 1774. And so the idea is we've got to recognize all these debts now. And that's only fair. They were willing to give us the country. And we were willing to be above board. If we gave had an obligation of a debt, we were going to pay it individually. And it was encouraging people individually. But by giving that authority to the government, it gave the government the authority to enforce to the extent that they could under the Articles of Confederation, and eventually the Constitution could enforce the payment of those debts through the legal process.
Jeez. Okay. Well, I guess that kind of answers my question on that one. I guess something too. I think it was about the Constitution. Oh, that's right. There was also a claim, too, that a litigant could not use the federal constitution to defend himself in court because he was not a party to it.
Which case was that?
This was Paddleford versus City of Savannah, I believe it was.
Oh, okay, yeah, that was in the habeas corpus guardian of liberty article, which I'm going to rewrite and move habeas corpus to the end so it makes more sense. But let me see if I can find it. The plaintiff's in error insists that it violates two of the provisions of the Constitution, that which declares that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, and that which declares that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. But what the tax they were talking about was that any non-resident. Now, in my youth, there were non-residents of the state. You had to be in, I was raised in California. You had to be here a year before you were considered a resident. Any non-resident who shall expose to sale any goods in this state shall, on his arrival or within 7 days after ending the same, make and return, and etc. He had to pay a tax of 31¼ cents on every $100 of value of stock operated upon. So what they're doing is they're setting kind of like a sales tax. And that's not within the jurisdiction of the federal government. So when they said that these people aren't protected by the Constitution, they're absolutely right, because the Constitution back then was between the federal government and anybody had dealings with the federal government, or the federal government and the state governments. That was, Baird versus Singleton, Barron versus Baltimore in 1806. The Supreme Court, Barron had a dock in Baltimore, and the city of Baltimore dredged the river to get a deeper channel. And when they did, they put the spoil in front of Barron's dock, and he said, "You've taken my property." Well, the Maryland Constitution didn't have an Article 5 in it, compensation for taking property. So the Supreme Court of Maryland said, "No, you cannot go after the city of Baltimore for the loss that you've suffered." And so Barron took to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, "You know, that's if you're dealing with us, but that's Maryland you're dealing with, and their Constitution chose not to insert that provision in it. That was the choice of the people of Maryland. So no, the decision of the Supreme Court of Maryland stands." When we look at it today, we think that the Supreme Court of the United States can tell us what toilet seats to use. But back then, it wasn't that way. And so when they said that it doesn't, what was the wording in that, doesn't come under the Constitution or something like that?
Sure. I think that sounds about right.
They were absolutely right. In that instance, it did not. There was no involvement. There was no jurisdiction by the Constitution that let them determine if that tax would be paid or should be paid or not.
Well, I think what's rather interesting here is that I think I can kind of gauge where this claim came.
Let me get one more quote out of the case.
Sure.
This is what the court held. They held that as soon as the passenger leaves the ship and lands and mingles with the citizens of the state, he becomes a subject of state taxation. And that was the decision of the court. So it was a state tax issue. It wasn't a federal tax issue.
Hmm. Well, I think probably the origin of this claim about not being a party to the Constitution probably stems from the conclusion of the Paddleford case, when the judge writing the decision said, quote, "But indeed, no private person has a right to complain by suit in court on the ground of a breach of the Constitution. The Constitution is true as a compact, but he," meaning the defendant, "is not a party to it. The states are the parties to it," close quote. So it's almost as if it's a whoever made this claim, it's almost like a misunderstanding about state citizenship, really, which I know you and I have discussed before.
Yeah, and that was the state citizenship one that we went through, that or the habeas corpus one. Either one of them addressed this very issue.
Mm.
That the Constitution back then, up until after the Civil War, the Constitution acted on between the states, or on somebody that had a relationship with the government by employment, by contract, or other means. It didn't act on the guy walking down the street. He had no relationship with the federal government at all. So, and that's, we're back in that era, 1854, when this case was heard, and there was no relationship between them. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment that the federal government began a slow but persistent encroachment upon the rights of the people by applying the federal Constitution to the first imposing it on the state to enforce the federal constitution, and later imposing it directly on the people, where they didn't have jurisdiction under the original constitution.
Right, of course. But in terms of this particular claim here, it's just like somebody read that sentence or two out of the Paddleford case and just kind of really misunderstood it.
Right. Well,
but yeah.
What's interesting is quite often, and this goes back 30 years, back into the early 80s when I first started getting into this stuff, frequently people will take a phrase, not even a whole sentence, but a phrase, might take a whole sentence. Seldom will they take the whole paragraph, which might give a context, and sometimes you need to read the paragraph before and after to get the context of what was said in the paragraph between the two. Often they'll take the arguments presented at the beginning. Side A said this and side B said this, and B won, but they'll take what side A said and use that as the quote. So they're not looking at it in context and what happened in court. They're looking at it in context, I'm trying to prove something that I want to believe. And so this phrase or this sentence fits it. So I'm going to use it. But I don't want it in context because that would mean that I'm wrong.
That doesn't surprise me in the least. Well, something that I keep noticing too with this claim that the United States is allegedly a British colony is a, shall I say, a sort of tenuous connection to the Vatican. I mean, for instance, like the first one of this set of claims related to the Vatican is that allegedly Britain is owned by the Vatican.
Well, I think King Henry VIII really dispelled any such absurdity. There was a document we were looking at the other day. Which one was that? That addresses that.
I believe it was the Treaty of 1213, or otherwise, or hell, even the Magna Carta at this point.
I don't think we found the 1213. We've got the
1455
and 1493. But back in that era, in 1200, a king could not sit on a throne. Now, England was different than the mainland Europe, but generally the king could not sit on the throne without the blessings of the Pope. And it was assumed that the Pope had underlying title by the grace of God to all the lands, which gave him the authority to approve or disprove the kings. Henry VIII wanted to get a divorce. Court wouldn't give it to him, so he said, screw you, I'm in charge of the Church of England now, which became the Episcopal Church, which was the one that was common in the colonies in the 1700s. So England kind of relinquished or gave up this relationship with the Pope, and now they own it. Henry VIII owned all the churches, and he set up his structure of ecclesiastic government within his country. He tried to instill that in this country, but the Protestants wouldn't have any of it. But many of the colonies had the Episcopal Church, or the Church of England. And in those communities, they were pretty strong, pretty influential, because they had the support of the royal governor and everything. But we began getting away from this whole concept of the church owns has underlying title to everything, because all they owned was the land that the church sat on, but their right to tax kind of implied they had some degree of ownership over the land around it, but it didn't apply up in Massachusetts, where it was full of Puritans. I don't even know if there were churches of England in Massachusetts. But the Pope claiming that he owns everything in 1213, and then we look at what even England went through during the periods after that, does he still own it? Or did he lose, was he divested of any ownership by the time King Henry VIII said, screw the Catholic Church, we don't want anything to do with them? So you can't do something in 1213 and expect that to be binding on us today, can you? I don't think we can. I
Yeah,
have a problem with that.
kind of similar to the earlier one about the British troops in 1790s, that this kind of seems all very similar. The timing doesn't match up at all.
Right. Well, look at claims too. Or reading about Oregon right now, it's kind of interesting that England and United States both had a degree of claim on Oregon, and the United States granted 2 20-year treaties to England, which implied the United States ownership. But I still haven't finished the book, so I'm not sure what was resolved. But eventually, we got Oregon, and we did it through the efforts of the missionary Whitman, who started to encourage people to come out there and figured that if we get enough people out here settling the land rather than just trading furs and things, then it's going to fall to the United States. The United States was resistant to it at first, and in fact, Daniel Webster was opposed to it, but Whitman went to Washington and talked to Webster and Tyler, who was president at the time, and got them to understand the value. They thought it was a wasteland, a desert, a Sahara out in Oregon. And it is in the eastern part, kind of, but the western part was very fertile. And so there are these disputes, but the right of claim, the first ship to go into the Columbia River was an American, and he claimed it at the entrance, but then he went back out and went back to work doing what he was doing. So then a British ship comes along, goes in and goes south and down, all the through the Columbia up into the gorge to the falls and everything. And he laid claim to it too. And so the argument that preceded Whitman and this other stuff that I mentioned was quite simply the British said, well, he only claimed the mouth of it. We claim the whole river because we went up further. Well, who has the right to claim ownership anyway? We know about who was it that went across the Isthmus of Panama and claimed all this land in the name of the King of Spain? Well, the claims are great if you maintain those claims, but look at California. They used it for trade only. They didn't really occupy it. Only the church occupied it, so they really had no claim on California, and they relinquished it quite easily because they couldn't defend it. They didn't have enough people living there to really occupy it, and the Americans were flooding into California. So the right of a claim of conquest even has limitations because he who uses the land really is the one that owns it. So to claim the United States that didn't exist at the time, the colonies didn't exist in 1213, to think that the Pope can claim the world, yeah, he had to go talk to the Muslims today and say, we own that land you're on. Put our churches back up and take your mosques down. There's an absurdity to the claim.
That'd be quite a feat, wouldn't it, right? Especially considering the possible reaction if he actually tried to do that seriously. Well, I
Well,
guess
let's look at
kind
it one more a little note I made when we were looking at this. If I give you the land I have today, does that mean that you also own the land that I qu acquire tomorrow? Now, United States was acquired tomorrow, long after 1213. Just putting a little perspective on it.
Yeah, I think the answer to that question pretty much tells us everything, doesn't it? Well, I mean, another claim too that is equally leaves a bad taste in the mouth, or at least in terms of believability for me anyway, is this claim that the Pope can abolish any American law or any law in the United States.
Well, there was a brother Richard, a Catholic brother, one of the various sects, Jesuit or something, I don't know, but Brother Rich in San Francisco said, quote, "The Pope, of course, has no authority over civil law in any country. He can, however, require Catholics in any country to act in accord with the Catholic principles under penalty of sin," or that would be excommunication. For instance, if the government would require parents to abort any child that had specific genetic deformity, a Catholic parent would not be able to abide by that law. So his extent, his authority is strictly over Catholics who could be excommunicated for violation of that. And those are changing all the time. When I was first went in the service, every Friday we had fish in school. And when I went to grade school and high school, every Friday, fish. Why? Because the Catholics said fish on Friday. But it was during the Vietnam era that the Pope apparently said, oh, we don't need to do that anymore because it's difficult to get all that fish over to Vietnam and feed 500,000 troops unless we buy it locally, and we don't know what might be in it if we buy it locally, so we're going to abandon that. So they got rid of it. Birth control has changes too. So the Pope can't force anything. The United States was just accommodating to the Catholics, the schools were, by putting fish on the plate on Friday. He can't tell any country what to do, nor could he even in Europe. He could put the king in, but the king had to violate a bull or something specific by the Pope before there was a conflict. Otherwise, in fact, in England, there were three laws, the king's law, the common law, and the ecclesiastic law. There were three elements of law, three different jurisdictions. The ecclesiastic law was the one that came from the authority of the Pope. It did not conflict with the king's law, nor the common law. The common law is a relationship between people. You know, if injury or damage to property or person, the king's law is obedience to the king for, say, taxes or military service or something like that, and the ecclesiastic law dealt with religious matters, faith, you know, being fined for not going to church on Sunday and things like that. So there were three jurisdictions, and there always have been multiple jurisdictions, even in this country. We have federal and state jurisdiction. We don't have ecclesiastic jurisdiction, but if you're a member of the Catholic Church, that's between you and the Pope.
Well, it's funny you should mention ecclesiastical law, because the only source behind this claim that the Pope can abolish any law in the United States comes straight from Volume 1 of Elements of Ecclesiastical Law. And so I decided to kind of look it up real quickly, and apparently there's not much in the actual source, but what's rather interesting is what it actually did say. Article 2 says of American canon law or of the national canon law of the United States. Item number 106, question is, what is meant by American canon law? Answer, by the national ecclesiastical law of this country, we understand the various derogations from the jus commune, or the different customs that exist among the churches in the United States and are sanctioned or tolerated by the Roman pontiff. We say are sanctioned or tolerated by the Roman pontiff, for as was seen, no national law can become legitimate except by at least the tacit or legal consent of the Pope. Again, the jus particulare of a nation always remains subject to the authority of the Holy See in such manner as to be repealable at any time by it. Hence, the jus national, or the exceptional ecclesiastical laws prevalent in the United States, may be abolished at any time by the sovereign pontiff. So that's what the actual source says, and it says it pretty much three different times in three different ways. It's talking about American canon law, that ecclesiastical law you just mentioned. It has nothing to do with anything the U.S. Congress passes, has nothing to do with United States Code, has nothing to do with any of the several state legislatures. Hell, it doesn't even have anything to do with the administrative agencies. This is only concerning, the canon law in Catholicism. That's it.
So fish on Friday.
Yeah, and what's really sad is that this citation right from Elements of Ecclesiastical Law itself debunks the claim that the Pope can abolish any law in the United States. That's what's really sad.
Well, if they took a phrase out of that, though, they would have their proof, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would, especially...
Right at the beginning there was something was said.
Especially the part at the end where it's said about laws being abolished at any time by the sovereign pontiff. But that's not like made by the government or the administrative agencies or anything like that. It's the ecclesiastical laws,
right,
in reference about the Catholic Church. You see, but just like how you mentioned about the different jurisdictions, you know, and the far past, kind of would seem to be the same thing here, that whoever made this claim that the Pope can abolish any law in the United States, really doesn't understand the issue of jurisdictions, like you mentioned, definitely doesn't understand Catholicism or even the basic structure of the, American law. It's just really kind of sad.
Well, that's what you get, though, when you, like I say, you take it out of context and it can mean anything you want it to be. I mean,
Right.
give you an example. I think I mentioned this a couple times before in these Behind Enemy Lines series, but many years ago when I lived in Pittsburgh, I was having a discussion. I don't even remember what it was about now, but the subject of water was instrumental to the discussion. And so he was saying all the water in the world you can drink. And I said, wait a minute, the ocean water, three quarters of the world is ocean. Probably 80% of the water in the world is salty or brackish or undrinkable. And he said, well, look, when I say water, I mean potable water. Well, without using the adjective potable, he wants water to mean only potable water, which makes it very difficult to discuss with him because he is so fixed on excluding 80% of the water in the world, which kind of mutes the discussion.
Yeah, it
And
would.
it's the same thing here. They try and take something that they think will exclude all else. If it's put in context, as you just pointed out, when it's put in context, though, and properly presented using the proper rules of the English language, we can see that they're trying to exclude what is truth by taking a phrase or a statement out of context, or maybe out of context, or maybe not even complete in its presentation to exclude all else, when the entire body of the document, the entire paragraph you read, disputes everything they said.
Yep. And it's really just, and so it would seem to be just that simple. And in a sense, that's scary, especially when people start spreading rumors and it's, and literally with nothing more than a paragraph straight from the source, it debunks it completely. But perhaps this is the nature of the Orwellian society we live in. I would probably just ascribe it to that. Something else, too, that kind of popped up as well was this other claim, Gary, that, the 1040 form, for like one of the IRS forms, the 1040 is supposedly a tribute paid to Britain.
Well, that we discussed earlier on the IRS publication 6209. There's nothing on the 1040 that says this goes to England. Nothing on it. Look at your 1040. If you were born in England, you might have England or Britain on it, but otherwise, I guess I don't, I haven't done one in so long, I don't remember. But I think the comment referred to the 6209 as proof of it, which talks about the 1040 form and the 1040X and things like that. But it, again, the only reference that anything that might be construed to mean include England would be the IMF, International Monetary Fund. But the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States is always the chairman of the IMF or president of the IMF. From Bretton Woods Agreement, we're the top dog in it. But individual master file is not the International Monetary Fund. But I can't find anything to dispute here. Now, here we got an exclusion. The 1040 form is a tribute paid to Britain. Wait. Right. Can you back that up? And like I say, the only thing in references that I've seen is the 6209 publication. So.
And yeah, and so 6209 not only does not say anything about British troops leaving until 1796, but it also doesn't say anything about it being some sort of, super secret tribute paid to the British.
Right. Well, it doesn't do anything with the 1796, really. It's the IRS publication. They weren't around then. But yes, it says nothing about tribute to Britain. If you go into the document and search for England, Britain, Great Britain, any London, anything like that, anything British, you don't find it. It's not in the document. There are some things blocked out. For some reason, they redacted just a phrase here and there, a couple, three places. But in context, you can't see a geographic entity or a country or anything like that being inserted within that because it would not fit the wording that precedes and follows that redacted portion.
I guess you didn't even find a reference to fish and chips, I suppose.
No, not fish or chips, either one.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess the next claim or two actually kind of, in a sense, go together because the sources that are claimed to support these are exactly the same two sources. The first claim is that the Pope owns the entire planet. And then the other one is that the Pope has ordered genocide and enslavement
Well,
of
there are
people.
two, the Papal Bull of 1455 and the Papal Bull of 1493. The significance of the second date we'll address shortly, but basically it's a continuation of the first one. The Papal Bull of 1455 says, "And by force of those and the present letters of faculty and acquisition already made, and what hereafter shall happen to be acquired, after they shall have been acquired, we do, by the tenor of these presents, decree and declare, have pertained and forever of right do belong and pertain to the aforesaid king, to his successors, and to the Infante, and that the right of conquest, which in the course of these letters we declare to be extended from capes of Bojadar and of Nao as far as all Guinea and beyond towards southern shores, as belong and pertain and forever of rights and belong and pertains to the said king Alfonso and his successors to the Infante, and not to any others." And then further down somewhere, it says that they have a right to enslave or kill people. I can't find that quote. Damn. Is that it? "We therefore, weighing all in singular premises with due meditation, noting that since we had formerly by other letters of ours granted, among other things, free and ample facility the aforesaid King Alfonso to invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever, and other enemies of Christ, wheresoever placed, and the kingdoms, dukedoms, principalities, dominions, possessions, and all movable, immovable goods whatsoever held and possessed by them, and to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery, and to apply and appropriate to himself and his successors the kingdoms, dukedoms, counties, principalities, dominions, possessions, and goods, and to convert them to his or their use and profit by having secured the said faculty, the said King Alfonso, or by his authority, the aforesaid Infante, justly and lawfully has acquired and possessed the islands, lands, harbors, and seas." Okay, he gave permission to King Alfonso, and I'm not sure what country Alfonso was for. It's probably in here somewhere, but he said, "You can go down and enslave these people. You can kill them. You can take their property." Well, hey, wait, wait, wait. He said, "And subdue all Saracens and pagans." Well, shit, that doesn't apply today, does it? The Catholic Church let the Saracens, well, almost let the Saracens use the tower at the Vatican to call their prayers and things like that. But you know, did they have the prayer there or not?
I think they did actually.
Well, they're not subduing all Saracens and pagans whatsoever and vanquishing them. So obviously, what he said in 1455 does not apply today, but he's talking only about Africa. However, when we go to 1493, one year after 1492, when Columbus discovered America for Portugal, and Alphonse might have been the king of Portugal at the time because they were pretty influential and may have been doing a lot of stuff in Africa. But he extended it to certain areas in the Western Hemisphere, thinking that they were in Asia, because in 1493 they didn't realize that there was another ocean between there and Asia. So he's giving permission to certain people to do certain things, but that's not binding now. They don't even live by this. We're not subduing the Saracens and the pagans. So to think that this document from 1455, what, six, five, four, 550 years ago, has any merit at all, and somehow binds us and makes us slaves? I'm not a Saracen, I'm not a pagan, so actually I'm excluded. So
Yeah, that would make more sense.
again, they see reduce their persons to perpetual slavery and to apply an appropriate. Oh, let's see, it also he could. to invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue. And I guess you could kill under that authority too. But, you know, that was then and this is now. And I don't know.
Well, the problem
also...
Stretch
some imagination to come up with some of this stuff. Really stretch it.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, what also kind of got me too about what you just read is the claim itself said that the Pope ordered the genocide and said enslavement and so forth. But what from you just read, it's almost more that he gave his blessing to King Alfonso, not that he was Alfonso's superior and ordered him like a subordinate to go, you know, murder folks.
Well, I didn't read the whole thing as rather lengthy, but I'm sure it also required a tithe for the consent for you to enslave these people. You got to give something back to the church.
Like a kickback, right?
Oh, kickback, tithe.
Now, that happens a lot now, doesn't it? But yeah, I'm sorry. It doesn't seem to satisfy the burden of proof at all. And in fact, kind of suggests a different situation altogether, at least to me. I guess the only other one of these Vatican-related claims, Gary, would be the claim that supposedly the Pope's laws are obligatory upon everyone.
Well, there was a reference that you gave me with the comments that were made, and I'm going to repeat what Brother Rich in San Francisco said. The Pope, of course, has no authority over civil law in any country. He can, however, require Catholics in any country to act in accord with Catholic principles under penalty of sin. Okay, but I guess they're talking, it appears they're talking about Benedictine the 14th, Diocese, DOC something, from 1844. And in 1844, there weren't many Catholics in this country. But why the Pope can sit there in 1844, because we already decided what he couldn't do in 1455. It was limited, and you know, it didn't carry weight. It died. How the Pope can sit there in the Vatican and say, my laws are obligatory on everybody in the world. Well, hell, not very far from the Vatican, they're destroying Christian churches and building mosques. So apparently, I think reality kind of disclaims the claim that we couldn't find in our research.
Sure. And I think for a lot of these claims, I think we're just kind of finding that out over and over and over again. There's also something else, too, and, you know, some of my friends kind of brought this up, too, because they like to focus on property rights and so forth. So this is kind of getting away from the Vatican angle of it. But there's this claim that supposedly, well, let me put it this way. I mean, do parents even own their own children?
Well, that gets rather interesting. Marbury versus Madison, one of the most earliest well-known cases in the United States Supreme Court by Justice Marshall, he pointed out something that was irrefutable. Don't misunderstand Marbury versus Madison. It did not say that the Supreme Court can interpret the Constitution in all cases, which some people have tried to attach a significance to, that if you read the case carefully, it doesn't say that. What he said is, when the executive branch and the legislative branch disagree on what is constitutional and what is not, the only one that can properly decide is the third branch of government, the tiebreaker, the Supreme Court. So, and that makes sense, doesn't it? You got three branches of government, one's at odds with the other. Who wins, legislature or the president? How do you toss a coin? What?
No, you need an arbitrator of some kind.
Oh, yeah, that's a good job for the Supreme Court. Why don't we let them do that? And that's exactly what Marshall said. So let's look at a marriage by license by the government. The government gives you a license to do what would... license is defined as permission to do what would otherwise be unlawful or illegal. I should say not unlawful necessarily, but illegal. Now, my first wife's parents had a certificate of marriage. They didn't have a license. They had a certificate of marriage on their wall. And they were Catholic, by the way. And I don't think they ever got a license. But if I get a license, and there's a, if I remember correctly, I've lost a lot of my paperwork, but there was a case I had a copy of, and I think it was 1926. It was from Arizona. And the judge said there's a dispute between the wife and the husband regarding the child. How do we resolve that? The court is the only one that can resolve it. And that's right. You got to have a tiebreaker. I wanted a partnership with a guy, and we disagreed, and we went to court to resolve the problem. How do you break a tie like that unless it's written in the contract? And the contract doesn't say the husband gets to make all rules in the marriage. It doesn't say the wife gets to make all rules in the marriage. So if there's a dispute, the court, the third party, since the government created the bond by virtue of that license, then they're a party to it. And I think the case said, and that extends to the offspring or the what's the word they used back then? The byproduct of the marriage, and that's the children. So the court then has a logical legal right in a marriage created by the government to be the arbiter in the case of a dispute between the two. Now, the problem is that's how it was back 90 years ago. But let's look at how it is today. The wife says this, the husband says this, and the court says, fuck you, I'm going to do this. So what they've done is, like they have everything in our lives, they've extended their authority where it doesn't belong, where it doesn't exist, not by virtue of the Constitution. It might by the laws, but the laws are unconstitutional if they extend into making a decision that isn't consistent with one or the other or somewhere in between. If it's opposed to the wife completely and opposed to the husband completely, the court has no right there, but they assume it. That's usurpation.
Yeah, that sounds like it completely. Well, I think kind of the underlying idea behind this claim is kind of a more foundational claim that allegedly we are slaves and own absolutely nothing. And one of the sources that was used to push this idea was something called Senate Document Number 43, which was issued by the first session of the 73rd Congress. And the name of the document was called, well, it was named after an article by George Thorpe called Contracts Payable in Gold. And a good chunk of this article is all about, well, paying in specie versus paying in, paper notes and so forth. But on, let's see, I think it was the top of page 13, I believe it was, where there's this one sentence that says, quote, "The ultimate ownership of all property is in the state. Individual so-called ownership is only by virtue of government, i.e. law, amounting to mere usure. And use must be in accordance with law and subordinate to the necessities of the state," close quote. Now, I don't know about you, Gary, but that almost seems to be almost like proof positive of something, except it doesn't really quite fit with the rest of the document.
Well, that's true. They talk about property, and it's rather ambiguous in talking about property in that context unless you read the entire document. And what's the entire document talking about? Gold, silver, specie, greenbacks, all methods of payment. And they're talking about going between the states, I think, as well. And here again, there's a paragraph that has paragraphs above and paragraphs before that set a stage. So if we take that paragraph or that portion of that paragraph and ignore everything else, then we can make it appear that property is the subject rather than the money or the other elements that are discussed in the entire document.
Sure. The other thing that kind of also gets me too about this is that just because George Thorpe wrote that one sentence does not therefore mean necessarily that it has like full legal force and effect. I mean, now it is true that this was printed by the U.S. GPO, the Government Printing Office, back in 1933, but I'm kind of a little skeptical as to whether this article, really what it is an article, is considered law itself.
Well, let's look at right at the top of that, submitted by Mr. Shipstead. in the center of the United States, April 17th, calendar day, April 24th, 1933. That was after the Banking Act. Resolved that the manuscript entitled Contracts Payable in Gold, quote unquote, by George Cyrus Thorpe, show the legal effect of agreements to pay in gold, be printed as a Senate document, and it's attested to by Edwin A. Halsey, Secretary of the Senate. Okay, now, you could enter a phone book or your mother's favorite recipe in the Senate record.
Right, okay.
Does it make it law, or does it make George Cyrus Thorpe's opinion?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was kind of concerned about.
They're asking the document to be entered in the record. So what? That's one side of the story. There might be another document that was the other side of the story. But even when we take George Cyrus Thorpe's story, they're talking about gold, silver, greenbacks, notes of credit, things like that. They're talking about economic property instruments. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to coin the currency.
So, yeah, and regulate the value thereof. Yeah.
Regulate the value thereof. And so is that the property they're talking of, whether it's gold or silver or greenbacks or promissory notes or any other form? That's the property they're talking about if you look at the context of this article. But this article itself is just the opinion of George Cyrus Thorpe, and Mr. Shipstead wanted it entered in the record.
Yeah, it doesn't therefore mean it's law.
It's
okay.
Not a law, no. It's just smaller than a phone book. But if you go back through the congressional record, quite often somebody introduces an article for information or as part of his argument. But his argument, as presented by this, has to do with property known as money, whichever form, because it doesn't talk houses, dogs, children, cars, airplanes, rifles, or anything like that. And there's no authority in the Constitution that it would extend it to that private property. But it
right.
does, the Constitution does address the credit of the United States, which would be the greenbacks or anything that was authorized by the United States through the banking system, the gold and silver coin, the gold and silver certificates.
Yeah, and look, I mean, when we're talking about property rights, we're either having a philosophical discussion, a legal discussion, or an economic discussion. And for, you know, me bringing forward this claim, you know, so you can kind of explain it to me and all that, I don't think we're having a philosophical or economic discussion. We're mainly having a legal one, especially considering that the only other source I could find that is supposed to back up this claim that we don't own anything, or not even our children, for parents and all that, was this other source on, I think it was called Weinhammer versus People. I think it was a New York State case back in 1856. And there was this one paragraph, or maybe I'll just stick to the first sentence, that says, quote, "The right of traffic or the transmission of property is an absolute inalienable right, is one which never has existed since governments were instituted and never can exist under government. The government is always regulating control to the full extent required in its judgment by the public interests and necessities, as the whole history of legislation will clearly show." Close quote. The rest of it pretty much goes on to say that talks about traffic quite a bit.
Yeah, now the interesting thing about that, though, is that's in the dissenting opinion. Now, anytime the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals in New York meets, they have, I don't know how many judges they have on this particular court that would rule on it, but this is State of New York, Court of Appeals, March 1856, prior to the Civil War. T.A. Johnson, justice, dissenting. So he's not agreeing with the rest of the court, and this is out of context, because this side didn't win, otherwise he wouldn't be presenting an argument that seems to imply that the right of traffic or the transmission of property is an absolute, an inalienable right, is one which has never existed since governments were instituted. That's not quite true because of the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution. If it's in commerce, the Constitution grants the authority of the federal government, the people granted the federal government the authority to control commerce between the states. But here's a dissenting opinion that is rather confusing in itself, but it's got no merit because it's the losing side of the case.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but aren't dissenting opinions in court cases not actually considered law?
Well,
I thought only the court opinions were the law.
There are arguments on both sides presented, but when it gets to the court held that's where you get into law. Now let's go back to Eschwander versus TVA. We will not rule on the constitutionality on any matter before this court, except as a last resort. And if we rule on the constitutionality, we will make it as narrow as possible. So. And that's the held, because they'll argue for pages. I mean, I've seen Supreme Court decisions over 80 pages long, and you read the whole thing, and they almost dispute each other because they're debating back and forth. They did back then. They were much more thought-provoking in their presentations. But then when they get to the bottom, they hold that, and usually that's in the bottom end. And that's where they're really creating that stare decisis in that held. The arguments that precede it can be argued under the case law system, which was about 1870 that was brought in. But what is held is the actual decision. And if you want anything to substantiate what you do, you have to go to the held and see the summation of what they've just presented in these extensive arguments.
Yeah, but since this is a dissenting opinion by Judge Johnson, then there's no court held that XYZ doesn't even come into play because this is a dissenting opinion,
right? Yeah,
you
got five guys playing poker, and this guy's got 2 threes, and he says, I win. No, you don't. We've all got a better hand than you. Oh, no, I win. He's the dissenting opinion. He didn't win. He just said he won. And here he even acknowledges that he didn't win. He's just getting his opinion, his thoughts. He spent a lot of time going over this case. And so he wants the record to show what his position was.
Well, in that case, then, Judge Johnson is acting almost exactly the same way that George Thorpe did, in that they're just presenting their opinions, and, you know, this isn't, you know, considered...
No, these are his thoughts. Sheepstead introduced Thorpe's article, and we don't even know what the discussion was that he introduced it to argue with. So that's a third, fourth generation. This is a first generation argument.
Okay.
So this is Johnson's thoughts. These are his words or his clerk or whatever. But
sure.
Rather than Sheepstead probably supported an enactment or a bill that was being presented or opposed it, one or the other. And it, you know, it could have been the Banking Act. Well, no, April. When was the Banking Act? It was March, and I think that was April, wasn't it?
Probably. That sounds about right.
So that would be after the Banking Act, but they might have been arguing some detail of enforcing the Banking Act or something like that. But we don't know which side he was on, what he was trying to support with the article that he chose to introduce. Now, if it's in an enactment, it's like the prevailing opinion in the court. The discussion by both sides is the level of Johnson here, because he's one of the two sides. In the Senate, there's both sides, one arguing for, one against. Here we got one arguing for, one against. So if Johnson, for example, said, I want this entered in the record, this was written by George Thorpe, that's a generation further away, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be.
Okay,
you know,
so it's not the same. This is one more step removed. The other article was one more step removed.
Sure. It just, I don't know, with everything we discussed tonight, I can't help but think that the people who are making these claims, especially the ones that I've discussed with you tonight, it's almost like they didn't bother to vet their sources. Hell, it's even worse than that. It's almost as if they didn't even bother reading them.
Well, they may or may not have read them, but... what the heck? Let's look at one of my favorite signatures. The conventional view serves to protect us from the painful job of thinking. So if enough people say it, I'm going to accept it. Britain owns the United States still, and we're still under the Pope. The conventional view, that's the one that everybody repeats because, hey, this is sensational. So that becomes conventional because everybody's saying it. It serves to protect us from the painful job of thinking. Ah, there you go. It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. Now, we've got a classic case here of twisting the facts to suit the theory. The theory being that we're still a British colony, or Britain owns us and the Pope owns us, and which is contradictory in itself, but that's the theory. And they're twisting the facts, and we've gone through the facts and shown how they're twisted to support the theory rather than having the theory suit the facts.
Well, I mean, I guess I should probably ask you then. I mean, do you think that this idea of the U.S. being a British colony, or perhaps being a Vatican colony, I guess, would have any connection with what you and I have previously discussed regarding the corporate United States myth?
Well, I think the facts that we presented in that one, that if you develop the theory around the facts rather than the facts around the theory, that you come to the conclusion that there is no corporate United States. And but see, the corporate United States would be in contradiction or conflict with this the thought that the Pope or the England owns the United States, right?
Or at the very least, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, or at the very least, well, it's still a corporation, it's just owned by a different set of tyrants.
But they didn't say that. They didn't say England owns the corporation. They didn't say the Pope owns the corporation.
No,
so
they didn't.
We don't have a bridge between these two ridiculous
assertions.
Yeah, there's no bridge between them.
It's almost as if the bridge, from what I've noticed over the years, it's almost as if the bridge is formed ex post facto, after the fact.
Right, but since they can't come up with anything that makes that bridge, they might imply it. The same person might put out the England owns us or the Pope owns us and is a corporate United States, letting the reader kind of bridge that himself because they can't put the two in the same article. It don't work.
You know, at times like this, I really wish people would just stop giving credence to these kinds of rumors and baseless assertions and instead focus on, like, the real provable information that's, you know, like, documented and such.
Take all the facts, lay them on the table, see what theory fits all the facts.
Wow.
Now, you might end up with two or three theories that fit all the facts if you don't have all the facts but only the facts that you've got. But those theories are going to be fairly close together if you've got a handful of facts. But as you pursue more facts, you can begin to weed out the theory or two that don't fit. But if I look at it the other way, here's my theory. I'm going to throw out this fact. I'm going to throw out that fact. I'm going to throw out that fact. And now these two, if I misrepresent them, they support my theory.
Jeez. It's like a con game almost.
It is. Now, you know, even more interesting, what's the consequence of this? Let's say that the Pope owns the king and the king owns us. So what are we going to do about it?
Right. I mean, I think the goal would probably still be restoration of constitutional government. I don't see really what the difference would be in terms of our actual actions.
For the men, there's two ways to get your leg wet. One is to have a pissing contest, and the other one is to piss in the wind. And I'm not sure which this is, if it's a pissing contest or if it's pissing in the wind. I would say they're pissing in the wind because there is no solution.
Right.
But it's a distraction. And it'll keep us arguing, oh, yeah, the king does own us. No, it doesn't. Well, I can prove it. Here's the stuff. And that's the stuff that whoever gave you that stuff gave you.
And, of course, the folks that argue those things will not do anything that will actually work, like setting up a committee of safety or any one of a thousand other things I'm aware of.
Well, most of the people will read that short synopsis that you've got from wherever you got it, and they're not going to go to Respublica and see what it says. They're not going to go to the Treaty of Peace and see what it says. They're not going to go to the Publication 6209 to see what it says. They're not going to go to the Treaty of 1213 and see what it says. They're not going to go to Elements of Ecclesiastical Law and see what it says. They're not going to go to the Papal Bulls of 1455 and 1493 and see what it says. And good luck finding Benedictine the 14th document from 1844, because we couldn't find it. They're not going to go to Tillman and Roberts and read it. There are, well, we didn't find that one either. They're not going to go to Windhammer, and they're not going to go to sit in a document 43 and understand them. They're going to believe, hey, he's got the evidence on. I'm going to give you a good example. About 4 or 5 years ago, a friend of mine from Phoenix, we used to talk a lot when I worked down there, and he and his wife were divorced, and his wife wanted the kid on Ritalin, and he didn't want the kid on Ritalin, and they were going back and forth. But he sent me an email, and it was a foreword. It was a very nicely laid out presentation, and it said, don't use your cell phone while pumping gas. And it talked about explosions and all this, and it gave a link. Now, I don't know how many, now a link's a lot easier than looking up Tillman or Senate Document 43 or something like that, because there were no links provided with this stuff, but we looked them up. But that link was there, and I went to that link. And this was a laboratory that was trying to make a cell phone ignite the gas fumes. They even took the cover off the phone, trying to make it ignite the gas fumes. They could not, any way, shape, or form, get that phone to ignite the gas fumes. But that was provided as authoritative proof that don't use your cell phone at gas pumps because it'll blow you up. So, in that case where it was easily there to push the button, click the link, and go read just a few paragraphs and see that it was hogwash, people didn't even do that. This guy was very conscientious, but for some reason, he chose not to go read the link. I wrote back to him, and he wrote back and apologized for even sending it out in the first place, and he sent it to everybody he sent it out to. So when the study requires going deeper and having to go find things, well, we'll just assume that all these things say what he says they say. Now we become adherents, proponents of this argument that the king still rules us, or the Pope, or somebody over there, that we don't rule ourselves.
And
then they pass it on, and all of a sudden you've got hundreds of people saying, the Pope owns us, the King owns us, I don't know who owns us, but we don't own us, and the court, the government owns our kids, and everything else we own. All the property we have belongs to the government. I read it, and I talked to Joe, and Joe knows the same thing that I do, and Sally knows it, and Sarah knows it, and Jim knows it, and everybody knows it. Okay. It must be true, unless you decide that you want to find out what the facts are and if the theory fits the facts.
And some patriots wonder why the government is still despotic as it is, probably because a good chunk of the patriots are allowing themselves to be led around by the nose.
Well, yeah, they've got to figure out how to depose the king, and then once the king's deposed, then they've got to depose the Pope. But what if they get a new pope? Because the pope owns the whole fucking world. So
right,
depose him, we're just going to get another pope as bad as the last pope. And he's going to own the whole world too. So what you have done is created an insurmountable object to restoration of constitutional government. We can't do it because it doesn't belong to us.
Wouldn't it also be something else like creating your own monsters or creating monsters where none exist?
There'd be monsters there. The old... 14th and 15th century maps showed the Atlantic Ocean, and if you look at all the maps, they've got all these exotic monsters out there, and they even say there be monsters here. Those monsters are in the minds of the people that don't want to go there. There was a guy named Christopher Columbus said, I don't believe that shit. Well, he'd done some research, and he'd found information from the Scandinavian countries that indicated that there was probably land there. So, you know, he wasn't going blindly, but see, he looked into not the pictures on the maps, but looked into the facts and said there might be land there. It might be Asia. I might be able to go directly to China. by traveling west. And so he ignored the pictures on the map because his theory was based on facts that he had found in other records than these maps created in Europe, the southern parts of Europe. And so he discovered America. Well, people debate that, but other people might have discovered it. But again, back to the right of conquest, until you settle land, it doesn't matter if you saw it when you drove by. Until you settle it, you ain't settled it. And so Christopher Columbus discovered America to the point that it began to become occupied, settled.
Well, Gary, I'm glad I decided to bring this forward to you tonight. It's just, these claims just seem so weird and outlandish that, you know, some other folks I know were taking them seriously. And so now I can pretty much go back to those associates of mine and tell them, this is just hogwash, you know, and so forth. And I think that'll probably, you know, free them up so that they can actually, you know, not use stuff like this, these rumors, as an excuse to sit on their hind end and not do anything, well, that it actually is possible to free ourselves.
You know, I've been seeing things like this for 30 years, and I get tired of it, but I think the fact that, you know, we can record this and people can listen to it or not, and if they want to look at the documents, we'll post the links to the documents so they can do it themselves. But, you know, to spend an hour or two to try and resolve this matter rather than everybody that tells me that the king still owns the country, I'm not going to spend 2 hours with everybody that said that to me, because I wouldn't have a chance to eat or sleep.
Right, and there's much better ways of making use of your time, as for all of us. So anyway, Gary, I just wanted to kind of pick your brain about that a little bit, and I think you really kind of cleared up some things for me as well, and I thank you for that very much.
Well, I'm glad I could help.
All right, well, good night.